Welcome to KUAR's Week in Review podcast, where we cover the news from the week that was, this edition, September 20th through the 26th.
The former First Lady of Arkansas touts her Methodist roots as she looks to the White House. Will Tom Cotton step into the fray?
A rare papal visit to the United States. How does Arkansas' sole Catholic congressman feel about an unorthodox message?
The battle over the Confederacy continues, a victory for secession in Batesville and a victory for 1957 in Little Rock.
Arkansas's governor pivots toward the defense industry with an eye toward federal dollars.
An in-depth look at the tragedy that sparked a review of the state's 911 system.
The maker of the classic video game Centipede on gender issues at Atari and the place of gaming in our lives.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
I'm Michael Hiplin.
I'm Chris Hickey.
And I'm Jacob Kaufman. This is KUAR's Week in Review podcast. The former First Lady of Arkansas, Hillary Clinton, the former Secretary of State, she visited Arkansas for the second time of this 2016 presidential campaign. Sarah, you covered it at Philander Smith College earlier this week. Can you tell us a little bit about her message?
Sure, Jacob. She spoke about her interest in addressing student loan debt. She was conscientious of being at a historically black college and tailored some of that to students in at Philander Smith, many of whom have heavy debt loads. She talked about healthcare and her support for the Affordable Care Act, her work on healthcare reform previously as a senator and also as the First Lady of Arkansas when she worked on a program for rural healthcare.
And when we're on the subject of healthcare reform, this week Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders made a lot of news about prescription drug coverage. Did she mention anything about that?
Yeah, she announced she would be coming out with a plan to set limits on prescription drug coverage costs. She also lauded the state for its compromise Medicaid expansion plan, the private option.
And I didn't get discouraged. I said, okay, what are we going to do now? And I went back to work with leaders on both sides of the aisle to help create the Children's Health Insurance Program that provides health insurance to 8 million kids in America. And nearly two decades later, I was so proud to be a member of President Obama's administration when he signed the Affordable Care Act. And you know what? It's working. The rate of uninsured Americans has fallen below 10% for the first time in 50 years. And the rate of uninsured African Americans has been cut nearly in half. And overall costs are growing at the slowest rate in decades. Yet all the Republican candidates for president are determined to get rid of the Affordable Care Act. Republicans in Congress have tried to repeal it 54 times. 54 times! Well, I am not going to let them rip away the progress we've made that has meant so much to so many. I'm not going to let them rip this law up and kick 16 million people off their health coverage and force this country to start the health care debate all over again. That's not going to happen on my watch. Why? Why would you repeal something that's working? And it's not just people who have insurance for the first time, it's people with insurance who have a better deal. What are you going to tell the 3 million young people who are now getting insurance because they can stay on their parents' plans until they turn 26? Why would you tell 129 million people with pre-existing conditions that they are in danger of losing their coverage? And why would you subject 158 million women and girls to the risk and indignity of being charged more again for health insurance than men are? Why would we do that?
A I spoke with some of the students who attended afterwards, and some of them, especially the freshmen, were saying, you know, they hadn't had any kind of political exposure before, and they weren't really sure who they supported, but Clinton had certainly made an impression by being there and talking to them. And she said she had met with activists from the Black Lives Matter movement, and what she told them was that at the end of the day, if they wanted to have an influence, that what they should do is vote. So she was trying to extend that message to the students there as well.
Hillary Clinton's remarks, she was sounded very ambitious. She has some very strong feelings about the Affordable Care Act, about health care. Your comments you just mentioned, affiliating with the Black Lives Matter movement. She seems distant from some of the Arkansas Democrats, maybe.
Hillary Clinton mentioned her working relationship with Barack Obama repeatedly and said that she would do everything in her power to defend the Affordable Care Act. So she didn't hesitate to support full health care reform.
And the president. We also had a little bit of presidential news in Arkansas on the other side of the aisle. We already have two Arkansans, former Governor Mike Huckabee, Hillary Clinton running for the 2016 presidency. A state legislator from Northwest Arkansas this week also launched a draft Captain Cotton website referring to our freshman U.S. Senator Tom Cotton. There's been some talk nationally, particularly from Bill Kristol, the editor of the Weekly Standard, trying to push Cotton into the field. At this point, the senator has said he's not interested or anything like that. But I spoke with State Representative Charlie Collins of Fayetteville, and he says that while he's talked to Cotton about this, Cotton has repeatedly told him he's not going to run, but he hopes this will encourage him to do so.
When there's a higher calling to service, when there is a bigger challenge on the table, when a person is called to overcome and serve in a bigger way, I think people get excited about the potential of doing that. So, is this an idea that, you know, Tom is, you know, he's currently ready to jump in and do? I mean, that would be presumptuous of me to suggest. But my belief is, as we have this discussion and as other people along with me, you know, continue to reach out to Tom and get him thinking about it, my hope is that, you know, he's going to see this as more and more a possibility and a probability, and that we need him.
And Collins would say he respects Mike Huckabee. He thinks the current GOP field is excellent. He just hasn't seen a front runner emerge. And he acknowledges that, yeah, this might seem a little late or remote, but he hopes it'll become more likely.
Well, Jacob, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker stepped out of the race this week. And there's been a lot of discussion about a contentious yet not unified or directionless Republican primary. What does Representative Collins hope that Tom Cotton would bring to this scene?
I think he agrees with him on a number of, I think most of Tom Cotton's positions fall in line with the existing presidential contenders on a lot of things, kind of hard on immigration, certainly against the Iran deal. But with Tom Cotton, most people look, including Charlie Collins, at his war record, his foreign policy stances. And he thinks Charlie Collins said something almost word for word to the fact that he's going to crush the evil dictators and kill the militant Islamists.
Well, Cotton was recovering from a disappointment this month when the Congress failed to block the president's agreement with Iran to the nuclear agreement, sanctions agreement. So what kind of leverage is he having right at this moment? And do you think he would have a chance in the Republican race?
Right. Republicans, while the majority of Congress is against this Iran nuclear deal, but they haven't been able to stop it from happening necessarily. And that's been a criticism of Senator Cotton, even when he's running for the office during an ATN debate. I think Mark Pryor asked him to name a bill that he had passed that he was proud of. And that bill was not named necessarily at that moment. So, but Cotton said all along with all of this that to stop the Iran deal, we might just have to wait until the next president. So for him, the battle will continue. It's not every year we get a visit from the Pope himself here in America. Chris, you watched the Pope's speech, some of his speeches and remarks to Congress, and you also spoke with French Hill from Little Rock, the congressman who happens to be a Catholic.
Yeah, that's right. The Pope didn't come anywhere near Arkansas, although, according to the Pew Research Center, about 8% of Arkansans are Catholics or identify as Catholics. And French Hill congressman from the 2nd District, the first Catholic congressman to represent that district here in Arkansas, and only the second congressman to be elected from the state who identifies as a Catholic, talked to me about the address. He was, of course, very excited that the Pope was there, as were the other members of Arkansas's congressional delegation. They all sent out statements. But French Hill, being a banker, is a capitalist. And as we've heard in recent months, the Pope has been very critical of the global capitalist system, the free market economy, creating a lot of wealth inequality. And of course, that's been a common theme in political discourse throughout our country and across the world. Now, the Pope never explicitly addressed capitalism or the capitalist system in his remarks to Congress this week, but he did talk a lot about poverty, uplifting the poor, really using business as a means to drive wealth.
At the same time, I would encourage you to keep in mind all those people around us who are trapped in a cycle of poverty. They too need to be given hope. The fight against poverty and hunger must be fought constantly and on many fronts, especially in its course.
Now, Congressman French Hill thought this message of uplifting the poor was consistent with capitalist ideologies or the capitalist system, at the very least.
Here's what I took away from it. He did say business is a noble vocation directed to producing wealth and improving the world. And in fact, the capital market system has lifted billions of people out of poverty and provided greater income. So I think he thinks of it in that way. Can the capitalist system build greater prosperity and give people greater dignity for work and opportunity? He also talked about corruption and corruption in the political system that takes away opportunity and reduces opportunities, particularly for poor people, and punishes countries in the third world when they have a corrupt political system that's too tightly connected to business. And you see that so much around the world that I know that he's got concern about government transparency and ending complacency and corruption around the world as well.
Now, French Hill is a very devout Catholic. In fact, after his election, there was a mass celebrated in his honor at Christ the King Church here in Little Rock. And he's a Republican and founder of Delta Trust Bank. So he obviously has a stake in building up capital. Being a part of that system, as I said.
French Hill, in his remarks to you, seems like he thought that the Pope's remarks about corruption and the political system was directed toward third world countries. But my impression, at least, was that is certainly the case towards all governments. But speaking in the heart of the United States government, he was, in fact, referring to the United States at some points about corruption.
Yeah, it seemed like the Pope was trying to spread an egalitarian message. And as we know, members of Congress are sometimes considered to be wealthy persons, and wealth is often concentrated in higher political circles. And, you know, there could be a slight nod to that issue. At the same time, it's easy to read into a lot of what the Pope was saying. But the Pope also addressed a couple of what are often considered partisan issues here in the United States, that being abortion and the death penalty.
The Golden Rule also reminds us of our responsibility to protect and defend human life at every stage of its development.
And this got one of the more rousing applauses of the day. As we know, it's a very partisan issue.
A lot of applause.
This conviction has led me from the beginning of my ministry to advocate at different levels the global abolition of the death penalty.
If you were watching the video, you could tell that, you know, Democratic members of Congress were probably more prone to applauding in that latter comment, and more Republican members were applauding in that former comment.
Worth mentioning that Arkansas is scheduled to resume executions after 10 years in early October.
Yeah, this has great relevance to our state. In fact, one of the notable members to be in Washington when the Pope was there was Little Rock Diocese Bishop Anthony Taylor. He was among the 300 or so bishops who were with the Pope during events in Washington this week. And Taylor was notable earlier this month for penning a column calling for the abolition of the death penalty here in Arkansas, as the governor and our attorney general and our corrections department have gone forward with plans to resume executions for 8 inmates here. Obviously, there's a moral message to be had, and whether or not it resonates in the political sphere, it's hard to say. French Hill, congressman from the 2nd District, thought that by addressing these two oft-competing mindsets, the Pope was trying to offer a balanced and unifying way forward, at least trying to reorient discourse in a way that's often been mired in a cloud of partisanship.
Well, I think the Pope, again, was talking about the responsibility to creating a civil society that lifts people up, and talked about collaboration in that responsibility among legislative bodies to build a better society. But he also had many, many moral lessons in his view, and life was one of them that was central. And so he felt that the golden rule, in his view, reminds us of our responsibility to protect and defend human life at every stage of development, which includes both at conception and in the death penalty. So I felt like his words were balanced. I think he outlined Catholic doctrine in a balanced way and provided that moral authority as leader of the church.
Always a tough situation when you're being asked, I guess, as a representative, if your faith lines up directly with the spiritual leader of your faith.
Right, and you could kind of tell there that French Hill was not trying to be contrarian to the Pope's message, nor was he necessarily trying to embrace it outright, although I think it's fair to say that it resonated with him.
Well, Sarah, it's that time of year again where we're looking back at another anniversary for Central High School, a traumatic moment in Arkansas's history that shapes a lot of the ways we look at the school district today, but also a very triumphant moment. But before we get to the anniversary of Central High School dates, there was some immediate news about the present way history is conveyed in Little Rock. Can you tell us about Confederate Boulevard?
Yeah, so since this summer, there's been a petition in the way to asked the city board to consider renaming Confederate Boulevard to Springer Boulevard. Parts of the street had already been renamed by similar efforts, and the Springer name is one of a prominent African-American family that's been in Little Rock for generations and lives in the southeast area where that road runs. There have been a couple of outspoken business people right on that stretch of the road who are not in favor and speak of the Confederate history of that particular part of town with a Confederate nursing homes, they say, during the Civil War era. And so
there's a Confederate cemetery right by there as well.
Right, exactly. So a planning committee approved this idea of switching the name. And so the city board of directors has to put it on its agenda and then vote on whether to change the name.
And they appeared to do so without much resistance. You mentioned a few people, but the Planning Commission at least seemed to be behind this deal. Transitioning, though, looking back to Central High School, can you tell us a little bit about what the occasion is, why we're talking about it today?
Well, Jacob, today, 58 years ago, is the day that the Little Rock Nine were escorted into Central High School with 1,200 federal troops called in by President Eisenhower after Governor Orville Faubus removed the state troops that had been blocking the students, and then a white mob formed in front of the school. So it was several weeks into the school year before the Little Rock Nine were able to enter with the support of the federal troops.
And you spoke with UALR historian who's a real expert on the Central High issue or any race relations in contemporary times from Arkansas, Dr. John Kirk, who's also the director of UALR's Institute on Race and Ethnicity.
So Dr. Kirk has been studying the integration crisis in Little Rock and the integration process and is interested in this long desegregation story that started years before the 1957 escalating crisis with the federal troops and has extended to the present day. So he speaks on that and the year following the integration of the school, actually all of the high schools in Little Rock were shut down. And this was a divergence from what he refers to as the Blossom Plan, which was to slowly integrate the schools over time.
Well, very slowly. When the schools reopened on a token basis in August of 1959, there were fewer black students attending schools with white students than there had been in September of 1957. So it's still very token, a very painfully slow process. The Blossom Plan was a phase plan, so high schools were first, and then the junior high schools went next. And so there was a phased plan throughout the 1960s. But of course, as we know, the school desegregation litigation went on for many decades after that. And it continued to be a very slow and laborious process. So in some ways, you know, Blossom's plan for token minimal compliance kind of, you know, ultimately prevailed. It was a very painfully slow process throughout the 1960s. And Little Rock went through a number of different plans and a number of different ways of kind of trying to hasten school desegregation in the city.
So North Little Rock and Pulaski County are still under a desegregation order. What's the state of this process now?
Well, a lot has changed, of course. The twists and turns in the school desegregation story in Little Rock have been pretty well documented. And, you know, busing was implemented in the early 1970s, which led to a massive growth in private schools in Little Rock, which offered a way of opting out of the school district. People moved out of the school district altogether to dormer towns like Cabot and Benton, which were out of the school district altogether. So the story really has been, after a successful period of desegregation in the 1970s and 1980s, which parallels with a lot of what was happening in cities elsewhere, from the 1980s onwards, you get a pattern of resegregation in Little Rock and other cities. And of course, today, Little Rock is around, the public schools are around two-thirds African-American and one-third white in a city that is roughly 50-50 black and white, generally speaking, you know, with the Latino population holding the balance between the two. So there's been a depopulation of the schools, but even that, in context of other places, is seen as a success. To be able to just keep a third of white students in the public school district is seen as a success.
Well, Sarah, Dr. Kirk gave us a look at the winding road towards integration. How far have we made it?
Well, it doesn't seem that the schools are by any means fully integrated. The Little Rock this last year resolved its court order desegregation requirements and now has lost the funding it was receiving, or will be losing the funding it receives through that next year. So it has to make up an extra $37 million a year.
All right, so we just heard about two victories for ending emblems of our Confederate legacy here in the South and in Arkansas. But Jacob, you covered this week a victory for people on the other end of this debate. What did we learn about what happened in Batesville?
Yeah, the story, there's a, like many county courthouses and small towns in Arkansas and throughout the South, the Independence County Courthouse in Batesville, there's a monument to the Confederate soldiers from the region. And in particular, there's a flagpole that has a Confederate era flag. It's not the Confederate battle flag, but it's a Confederate flag, basically. And they took it down after the shooting in Charleston out of respect for everything, seeing what other places had done. Fort Smith, for instance, got rid of all of their rebel attire and things like that. But the county quorum court and the county judge and some of the people there evidently decided, we've been respectful long enough, it's time to raise the flag again. So they raised the flag. And the reason why I wrote about this happened a little bit earlier this month, but I wrote about it this week because, one, the county judge there switched from the Democratic Party to Republican Party, made me think of it. And the second reason was because of the issue before the Little Rock Planning Commission about Confederate Boulevard. what I discovered earlier was that the Sons of Confederate Veterans group in Arkansas, which is heritage groups, they don't claim to have any active political mission other than preserving their ancestors' memory and valor and virtue and such. They sent out a thank you note to everyone for helping to get the flag raised back in Batesville. They'd held a number of rallies, staged a number of speeches and things like that, and they explicitly thanked the League of the South, which is this future-oriented neo-secessionist group that believes in building a white ethno-state, white Christian ethno-state in the South. You know, I asked the county judge, and he claimed he didn't have any knowledge of the group, which he very well might not have. I just took a look at that, and it's kind of unusual to me. It's a new step in all of this that the Sons of Confederate Veterans group would ally themselves with these type of radical groups like League of the South. Traditionally, you would not see the Sons of Confederate Veterans openly associating with the Klan, for instance.
Yeah, and we should note that the Sons of Confederate Veterans were also instrumental in blocking legislation earlier this year to separate Martin Luther King Day from Robert E. Lee Day in the state. And also, I thought it was interesting that your article noted the kind of coverage pattern of these organizations in local media. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think this is just because the League of the South is relatively new. It was founded in the mid-90s and really only formed in Arkansas after the Dylann Roof shooting. And probably more appropriately, the drive to get rid of those symbols really made that group kind of grow, Confederate symbols. They've had three events in Arkansas that were explicitly hosted by them. They've attended multiple flag rallies and things like that. And each one, one was about Christian marriage. One was about third world immigration harming poultry practices of people in North Arkansas. And one was just in defense of the Confederate flag. Each one, the media stations would say, like, maybe they would say it's a controversial group, or they'd say something about the Confederate flag. And one in Fayetteville TV station did note at the bottom of a story, their ultimate goal is secession, but they all kind of mention it offhand. But the fact is that this group is very explicit in a lot of its goals, and it's a lot more radical than any of these type of other heritage groups are.
And it's labeled by the Southern Poverty Law Center as a hate group.
As a hate group, yeah, explicitly. And their founder, let me just read you a couple things. I pulled some excerpts from essays of him, Dr. Michael Hill. He said, so when they call you a racist or a white supremacist, remember that they will have called your Southern ancestors that as well, that you're in good company with Lee, Davis, Stevens, and a host of other honorable men. Laugh in your accuser's face and relish that good company. So they certainly don't shy away from being called racist and things like that, at least their founder in those statements. I wanted to mention one other thing about the Martin Luther King Jr. Day debate. While the Sons of Confederate Veterans was very vocal in that, the very first person to testify in favor of keeping those days together was a former state representative, Loy Mock of Bismarck, Arkansas, who at one time was a member of this group, the League of the South. So it's kind of interesting to me to kind of explore the connections between these relatively benign heritage groups that do reenactments and things like that, and these groups are a little bit more radical that explicitly say they want to secede from the country. And a couple days after the Martin Luther King Day debate, the effort failed to disjoin the two holidays. They actually put up a secession billboard in Harrison. So that's another tangent.
Any upcoming events that they have planned?
I don't know of any, but I have gotten a lot of emails recently of people who've been at these rallies and taken some pictures of people and noted that there are famous extremists from all over who have managed to make the trek to Arkansas in recent months. This week, Governor Asa Hutchinson announced a new initiative to support military installations in Arkansas. Michael Hiblin, you were at the announcement at Camp Robinson in North Little Rock. What's the goal?
Well, we have possible cuts to the defense being considered in Washington, and Governor Asa Hutchinson was joined by hundreds of National Guardsmen. That's where the Arkansas National Guard is based. And he spoke about the importance of working to protect current military installations in the state, as well as trying to bring new missions to Arkansas. Here's what some of what he had to say.
We need to do more as a state to signal our support and to put tangible results behind our community support and state support for our military installations. And so I'm pleased today to announce that I am forming the Governor's Military Affairs Steering Committee. This will be housed in the Arkansas Economic Development, I think it is very appropriate that it is in that agency. And this Military Affairs Steering Committee will have the purpose of supporting our military installations. It will be a public-private partnership where we're putting public resources and leadership behind this effort, utilizing our community support and our private sector support to showcase what our military installations do in Arkansas, generate more community and state support, and hopefully to bring more missions and expanded missions to these installations.
And 10 people will serve on that steering committee with the goal of really determining what can be done to show support to the military in ways that haven't been done before. He is also allocating $400,000 from a discretionary fund that he has to pay for this initially to get it started. He'll decide later based on recommendations whether or not more money will need to be allocated to keep this going. But the initiative, as he said, will be part of the Economic Development Commission. The head of that, Mike Preston, who the governor appointed a few months ago, said it's important to remember the economic impact that places like the Little Rock Air Force Base have on the state. It alone has an estimated $813 million local impact. It's also the fourth largest employer.
We got to use these as economic development drivers. They're anchors in our community. How can we better support them? And we as a state, we're not doing a good job of offering that support. So the governor asked us to sit down with his office, who did an incredible job, and Ken Griffin and his team to come together and let's figure out how we work this out. And very early on in the process, we realized, you know, this is bigger than a state agency. This has to be a public-private partnership. We have to have businesses at the table. We have to have the congressional delegation at the table. And then we have to have the leaders of the military at the table as well. So this is a perfect example of a public-private partnership coming together, working for a common cause, a common good. And I think you're going to see us really even starting today, rolling up our sleeves and supporting our military installations.
And it's important to note, too, that this comes only a few weeks after Arkansas lost a major military contract to build the next generation of military vehicle. That was going to be, they were hoping, built down in Camden at a facility. But Governor Hutchinson said the talk about this has actually been ongoing for many months now, that this wasn't a direct response to that, but said that the effort by the legislature allocating funds as part of a project to try and lure that project to Arkansas is an example of what can be done to try and bring more of these military contracts to the state.
Continuing his philosophy that that's a good partnership with the federal government to do.
Yeah, and worth noting, too, he appoints a steering committee. Yeah, Governor Hutchinson has really been big about appointing task forces, steering committees, groups to look at challenges facing the state. You have a task force on Common Core, another one looking at the future of the private option. So this is yet another example of the governor trying to bring in other people to study an issue over a period of time and then make recommendations.
And it's also something I covered the Delta Regional Authority this week. We hear a lot, especially during election season, from the GOP presidential candidates that it's good to get the government out of the economy as much as possible. But we've seen with the Hutchinson administration in Arkansas, that if it's a private option, if it's something with the military, there are instances where they think federal dollars has a positive contribution, seems like.
This is certainly different in that, but the military, obviously, you know, that's such an important part of Arkansas. We've lost a lot of major installations in the state over the decades. Acre Air Force Base over in East Arkansas, for example. And it's a big loss to these communities when you lose these kind of facilities or even contractors. So this is one example where they say, yeah, we do want to bring more government, do what we can to try and build something like this that really can help the state economically.
Michael Hiblin with KUAR, our news director, thank you for joining us for this segment.
Thank you.
Sarah, this week you had an opportunity to look back through some 911 footage, some tape from a really tragic incident that happened that's cast some attention statewide about just how up to date Arkansas's 911 system is. Can you tell us a little bit about that story, and then we'll take a listen to it?
Yes. Yeah, so a few weeks ago, attorneys for the state of Jingle Yi, the woman who died in a drowning accident when 911 didn't respond adequately to her call 2 years ago, her son recently died from complications related to that incident, and the Little Rock 911 Center has done a comprehensive review through a consultant group, which is coming out at the end of the month. But generally, state officials, local documentation of issues at the call center around staffing and technology all seem to point to some widespread issues with centralization, funding sources as technology's changed, and 911 systems can't take the same taxes from landline phones they used to get. And this is a national issue. The state has a Blue Ribbon Committee reviewing the 911 system. They issued a report this year and found those overarching problems. But basically, the state legislature implemented 911 in 1985. It's the duty of the state to find adequate funding sources for it. And right now, counties are paying for their 911 systems, and there's a lot of divergence between them in terms of the technologies they use and the training they implement. No central oversight in the state. So members of the committee are working to come up with a legislative plan for the 2017 session, but very much a work in progress. No immediate solutions in sight for what, you know, are obvious problems in the system.
And timeliness is certainly something at the forefront of everyone's minds when you think about 911, but it looks like it'll be at least a year.
Right. I mean, it's hard to imagine that for our generation, that there was ever a time before 911 that it was implemented as late as 1985, but I certainly think that it's there and people just expect that it works and don't question that.
So I tried to play a little bit of Centipede earlier this week on the browser, on the computer, not quite the classic 1981 arcade-style Atari game, but I didn't get too far.
Really?
Didn't get too far.
You didn't destroy the centipede?
Well, that's the difficulty with it. When you shoot the centipede, it breaks up into even more pieces, and you have to destroy the different pieces of the centipede.
But I guess the key is to only destroy the tail and then work your way down.
I never figured it out that far. But I was playing Centipede because I interviewed Donna Bailey, who graduated from UALR and used to be a professor here. She gave a speech at the Venture Center this week in Little Rock, and she was one of the only women designing video games at all in the early 1980s. She happened to get a job for Atari and designed Centipede. She's a really interesting woman. She worked at GM before. She never even played a video game about a year before she designed and made Centipede. Her friend just took her to an arcade and had her play Space Invaders, and she thought it was really cool, and it reminded her of her computer programming job at GM.
How did she get the idea for a centipede?
It wasn't her idea, it turned out.
Oh.
There was a, you know, they had like brainstorming sessions, and they went through a list of ideas for her to work on, and she picked it because she thought, oh, shooting a bug, that doesn't seem that bad. So she decided to go with it, and she added bouncing spiders in there, but she doesn't like spiders.
Nobody likes centipedes either. They're kind of gross.
So when I talked with Donna Bailey, she mentioned a little bit how being one of the only women in this field was a little difficult. She said it was like working in a fraternity, which she said had its lighthearted moments, but also its difficulties. And she mentioned, of course, today, only about 10 or 20% of computer game developers are women, still a very small amount, even though the percentage of video game players has grown to about half and half. But after she designed Centipede, 1980, she only stayed with Atari for a couple of years, and she quit the world of video games for two decades. She just didn't design anything. She moved on. She went on to teach rhetoric and writing at UALR, and I spoke with her about the current state of video games. Obviously, when she started, she hadn't really heard of them. Now everybody's heard of them. They probably can name a few titles as well, but she thought maybe all the development and growth in video games really wasn't the best thing in the world.
Frankly, if I had known what I know now about how much people would play games, I don't think I would have been as eager to be associated with games. I'm a big reader, and I've always been a big reader, and that has helped me be a better scholar and a better student. I wish that people would focus a little more on other things, reading and writing skills. I'm big on writing skills still. Honestly, when I started to work at Atari, I thought it would be something like when we played board games when I was little. I mean, we just had a healthier mix, I think, of concentrations and preoccupations. So I would like to see a return to that. And I would like to see games bring more to the table in terms of the skills that they offer and a broadening of experience that they offer. I mean, games could be so much more in terms of music and art, and, you know, it could just be such a wider experience.
And Chris, Donna Bailey, when I interviewed her, she was sitting in the very chair that you're sitting in right now.
I feel honored.
Well, Chris, before we conclude this podcast, played any good video games lately?
The last video game I played was this one called Clash of Clans.
Is it a console game, a computer game, a phone game?
It's actually a phone game. It was a way to bond with fellow coworkers at a local restaurant that I once worked at. And they had a clan where you develop a village by mining gold and other resources and building things and building an army and going and attacking other villages that aren't in your clan. And then your clan also starts wars with others, and you gain more resources and just build up your village.
Practicing valuable skills of humanity on your phone every day.
Right. Pillaging and mining for gold.
All right. That concludes our very segmented recording of this week's Week in Review podcast for KUAR Public Radio here in Little Rock. We are part of UALR, though editorially independent. Our theme music is by our own Chris Hickey. I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Chris Hickey.
Thanks for listening. This was the Week
in
Review podcast.
Goodbye.